Hello and welcome back to the WealthFest podcast with me, Marty Guilfoyle. The health, fitness and wellness podcast brought to you by WealthFest and their presenting partner, KBC. I'm so excited to be back for a second series. We'll be speaking to another incredible lineup of industry experts, hearing their inspiring stories and motivating us to move well, eat well and live well. This podcast, supported by KBC, is just one of many health and wellness resources available on wellfest.ie to help you on your wellness journey. With thanks to KBC, we'll be tapping into a wealth of knowledge with our guests to empower even more people of all ages to prioritise their health, fitness and well-being. Now, let's dive into this week's episode. Former professional rugby player James Haskell is one of the best known sports people in the UK. James is an author, podcaster, presenter, professional DJ, and he also campaigns for a variety of charities. James, welcome. It is such a pleasure to have you on. How are things?
Yeah, very good. Thank you. Thank you for having me on. It's always nice to have the dulcet Irish tone.
Let's go back to the start. Okay, so you've played for England 77 times. At senior level rugby, and you've also toured with the British and Irish Lions. So you've reached the top level of the sport that you played for your country, and it had to have been a dream come true. And I understand that you just started playing rugby at the age of 5. Do we have that right?
Yes, it is, yeah.
What a journey. Tell us a bit about that journey from you know, picking up a rugby ball for the first time at the age of 5 to representing your country at such a high level.
Well, it's even more an exciting journey considering I didn't want to be a rugby player and I wasn't very interested in rugby. So it kind of came as a bit of a shock, really. I mean, my childhood and sort of those early years was spent like outside. Like my life was kind of, my knowledge of life and what was going on was sort of just in between playing army outside. I'd just park my bike up, come in, get some squash, but I'd be out of breath and then just run off again. And like, you know, doing stupid stuff. And I wasn't really very aware. I had quite a charmed childhood. I'm not sure I was that bright, but I sort of kind of really enjoyed life, doing all the things that probably kids don't do now.
Yeah.
And I was out, you know, as I said, I spent all my time playing army. I think I really wanted to be in the SAS, which was never going to happen most likely because I was probably going to get shot by my own side. But I loved diggers as well, you know, and construction equipment. So my childhood was just spent doing all those kind of things. And I got taken down to Maidenhead Rugby Club when I was 5. My mum lied about my age and got me signed into the under 7s because I was quite a big kid.
Yeah.
And I think it was my dad, you know, dad found an opportunity to go for a drink on the weekend because back in the day, you know, early sort of 1990s or whatever it was, you couldn't drink in pubs on Sundays. They didn't used to open them. So rugby clubs was the perfect crime to go. The dad's going, have a few pints, the kids try them out, and the mums do whatever mums do when no one's around. I mean, my mum seemed very happy when we came back. So I don't know what she was up to, but it was, you know, everyone was kind of happy all round.
Is this like you inadvertently saying that your successful rugby career is as a result of your parents dying for a drink on a Sunday?
Yeah, basically. My mum was sick of my father and my dad just desperate to have a pint at all costs. I played Maidenhead Rugby Club and really enjoyed it, but I wasn't really aware, didn't really watch rugby, didn't really watch, you know, now kids have got sport on demand. You know, they emulate their heroes. You know, you look at most young football people, you know, they're always kind of, you know, playing with the ball. I was doing everything. And then I basically went to Wellington College later on, probably when I was about 13, 14. Mm-hmm. And they took rugby to a whole new level. And I was surrounded by kids who were like wearing shirts of their teams and were like talking about the games on the weekend.
Yeah.
And you know, trying to emulate, you know, the Lions players and All Blacks players. And I was like, just what is going on? And I remember trialing for I was probably 14, 15. They were called the Yearlings, but it was like the first 15. I didn't get in. I just remember seeing these kids taking it so seriously and I had no idea what I was supposed to be doing. And actually, the first game of that season, I was in the second team, and my friends still remind them now, especially the bloke who took my place, was like, oh, I'm better than you. And I was like, mate, we were 14, like, you need to relax. And I basically, you know, I scored a couple of tries, I think, and they were like, look, they put me up in the team, and a teacher put me from second row to flanker, because we just started playing, having, you know, 6-8 in the scrum or whatever. And I just fell in love with it. And basically, because of the fact that boys were watching it, you sort of started to live and breathe it. That coincided with my dad taking up watching Wasps. You know, him and my, I came back once from a weekend at school, and him and my brother, who was younger than me, had all these like Wasps stash, these hats, these, all this rubbish that they,
all the kid, okay.
And I basically was like, what's all this? And they're like, oh, it's Wasps. You know, I'm not sure you're invited. Standard, like, you know, mugging me off. So I was like, no, I want to go. And then I went to, started watching the games. And then for the first time in my life, I became a fan of something. Uh-huh. So we started going to away and home games of Wasps. Then I started watching it. Then I got into it.
And so are we looking at here, are we looking at you starting playing rugby at five and you didn't become a proper fan of it for at least 10 years afterwards?
Yeah. Genuinely about 14, 15, but I'd say 15 was when I became a fan of rugby. I didn't watch it before then. I remember my first kind of, my dad sitting in the sort of sitting room watching England versus Australia in the 1991 World Cup or whatever it was. And I remember walking in on that and just asking what was going on and sort of not really paying attention. I'd been to a couple of Twickenham games, didn't really care. Uh-huh. And then at 15, when we started supporting Wasps, that coincided with me trialing for England under 16s, you know, because because when you were in that kind of school system, you sort of had a go at it. And I got all the way to the final trial and then I didn't get in. And basically for me, who had quite a charmed life, I hadn't really had a lot of disappointment. I'd kind of had a privileged background.
Yeah.
I know it was like very much first world problems, but I didn't get in and I took it really badly. I think, you know, I cried. I mean, I think it's probably the last time I did ever cry, according to my wife, as I'm emotionally dead. And I basically, you know, the issue was that I've been told to do a load of extra work. So they gave each player this booklet and it was like quite draconian and a big expectation on a 14, 15 year old kids to do it. And I basically didn't do any of it. I procrastinated. I think I was trying to chase girls at that time.
Yeah.
And I basically just didn't do it. And then when I didn't get into the trial, I had no one else to blame but myself. And that's very difficult for a young person to take. And my dad basically said to me, look, you can see this as an opportunity to get better and come back because you know you didn't put the work in, you know you didn't do what was required of you, or you can just play rugby for fun and just forget about it. And that was like a watershed moment for me in my career, because I then was like, okay, hold on a minute. It doesn't sit well with me. I know. And I've referenced my dad a couple of times, is that he taught me another expression, which I take through to life now and I recommend to everybody. And it's something that nobody can escape from, is you can lie to everyone else, but you can't lie to yourself. Uh-huh. And only you know about whether you put the work in, whether you're a quitter, whether you're whatever these things are. And I knew that I hadn't done it. And basically there's a friend of the family, a guy called Henry, who was a kind of a personal trainer. And a bit like a Rocky montage, I started kind of age 15, doing weights and training. And a year and a half later, I came back and got into England under 18s as captain. And I was bigger than everybody else, fitter than everyone else, stronger than everyone else. And it was a complete transformation. And it changed me, you know, on so many different levels. It showed me that if you put work in, you get what you want. If you're dedicated, you get what you want. If you sacrifice, you get what you want. If you are prepared to go above and beyond, you'll get what you want out of life. And that was a really early lesson where I think some adults don't discover that until later on. And that's what shaped me into my career. And once I was on that path of like trying to get better, I just wanted more. So I was like, well, I do England under 18s. I want England under 19s. I want to, you know, Wasps offered me a contract when I was still at school. And I went and did a pre-season with them while I was still only 17.
That must have been crazy considering you only became a fan of them 2 years previous to that. Yeah,
well, it was. It was mad because, as well, I went and played adult rugby while I was still going into my last year of school. And it kind of ruined my last year of school purely because I had all these like professional ideals and, you know, forgot that kind of that last year of rugby was the very last kind of carefree sport I was going to play. I got offered a contract. I deferred my university entry to read history at Exeter. I don't know why. And then basically 18 and 19 and a half seasons later, I was still doing it. And that's how it came about. It was never meant to be a job. It was meant to be a bit of fun to see how I got on.
Yeah.
And then here I am now.
And so when you got to that point in school where, you know, everyone's in their final year of high school, essentially, and you're playing at such a high level of rugby, you know, were you enjoying it? Or was it a case of where you knew this is what you had to do? You knew where you wanted to be. You kind of probably saw all your friends going out and doing the typical teenage thing. And you probably weren't part of that because you were so into the sport.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I used to work. So this is, again, super sort of posh middle class life. But at Wellington, we used to have a school bar for the last year of the last year students. Uh-huh. and I worked behind the bar. You know, I think it was on a Thursday evening. You could go in there for an hour and have a couple of beers or whatever. And I used to serve the pints, and I never used to drink. And I look back at that now, and like everyone else is drinking. I just never used to drink. I was like so dedicated to what I did. Yeah. And I was thinking, I had free drinks at my disposal.
Yeah.
And I just didn't do anything about it. And like, when you get later on in life, you're like, free drinks don't come around very often.
they really don't.
So I should have monopolized that, but obviously I didn't. And there's things that I, you know, a lot of people go on boys' holidays, went to university, yeah. went traveling, you know, did all this stuff. I just didn't do that. You know, where other people were going out enjoying themselves, I was waking up and training.
Yeah.
It was really very much like a Rocky Montage thing. Like I would run part, we basically did our homework 7 till 9. And then you had an hour free 9 till 10, and bedtime was 10 o'clock. Mm-hmm. From 9 till 10 every evening, I would be in the school gym, or I'd be running up hills in the dark. My trainer would come and I'd be running on pitches in the dark, doing extra fitness, swimming. Like it yeah. was really like Rocky, just, you know, just as everyone else was kind of resting, I was doing it. And it became my recipe for a success, but it also became a bit of a obsession that meant that I was never that satisfied, because you always wanted to do more.
A lot of the listeners that we have to this podcast are looking for that inspiration, you know, and to hear somebody get to your level, which you got to that's what you had to do, you know, hopefully it will spark that inspiration for somebody else. But unfortunately, your rugby career, you could say, kind of came to a bit of an abrupt end because of an ankle injury. Tell us a bit about the injury and how you felt, you know, like it was adjusting to life after that injury had happened.
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult one, really, because...
Because you sound like somebody who's just like you were talking about, you just want to get up and go.
Yeah, no, I am like that. And, retirement's been kind of an interesting thing. And it's fun in lots of ways. It's very hard in lots of ways because, you know, I'm 36 now, 36 this month. And I've got more, hopefully, potentially more life to live doing something else than I did my first career, which is quite interesting because most people spend their whole time building up to something. I built up to it and finished it, and now I've got to find something else to do. And the retirement thing was, you know, was hard because I had a major toe injury. I know it sounds quite annoying and a bit sad, and David Hay made toe injuries not really cool, but I ruptured all my... plantar plate, tendons, ligaments in my big toe. And you need your big toe for everything. And if you don't appreciate it until it's not working properly.
Yeah, it's one of those smaller cuts tend to hurt the most, don't they?
Yeah,
really?
Exactly. Yeah. And basically, it's 2016, I had this. I had surgery. I was out for 9 months. I got back and I was, kind of managed to get back playing. All because actually Under Armour, the boot company, sent me a pair of American football boots, a size too small.
No way.
Because they were so rigid, it meant that I could run around and play. And I was about to quit then because I just couldn't deal with the pain. I couldn't play. And I remember putting these boots on and going running around and being like, oh my God, it was better than any moment in my life. Just that relief of being like, oh my God, I can actually run. I can play. This is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of amazing. But the ankle injury, I basically had always had a problem with my ankle. I hurt it playing against France, and there was issues with it. And basically when I went to run in my last year at Northampton, I kept getting pain. So they said, listen, we'll do an operation to clear it out and then we'll go again. And by the time I came back from that ankle injury, my toe was just awful. For some reason, it was terrible. It just didn't work. So I then basically retired because of the toe.
That's such a mad thing to hear. Like something so small just caused you to, you had to just give up.
I just couldn't run. Yeah. I just couldn't run. And also, I think because there's no let up, because you're contracted, you kind of have no let up. And I saw some other medical people. And subsequently, since I've retired, if I'd seen some other people, I think I probably could have played on for another year or so, which is the frustrating part. But subsequently, since I retired, my ankle has become awful, like terrible. I basically just got flat out arthritis in it. I've got no cartilage in it, so it's bone on bone, which means I can't run anymore, and I haven't run for about 2 years, unless I run after my dog when he ran off, all featured in the newspaper. They saw me sprinting off.
No way.
Yeah, that was, they caught the day where I was at,
they were like, oh, James the liar, we caught him running.
Yeah, well, no, it's even worse than that, is that I was at my in-laws house, and there's always press sort of hovering around, and I basically, the dog ran out the garden across a main road into a park, and he's not very good at coming back when he's called, especially when he sees other dogs.
What dog is it?
He's a Labrador.
Okay, go on.
Yeah, and basically he ran out the door, and my wife poked her head out the door, instantly saw a press and was like, no, your job, James. I was like, what? I had to go across the road to get him. I called him and he was about a football field away and he looked at me and he just ran off and I basically tried to keep my cool.
That dog looked at you and was like, let's see what gas you've got left in the tank, man. Let's go. Like, yeah.
And basically, I then ran across two fields, grabbed him. Then basically, I then had to carry him back. But the press, the Daily Mail ran this story, like, James Haskell enjoying fun walk with his dog.
And you're literally sprinting after
him. And I basically then obviously wrote, fun walk. This is utter rubbish. It's hell. And then they then posted the actual photos where I've gone to pick him up. He squirmed out my hands. It's all on my Instagram, at James Haskell, if you check it out. And I've got him like the end of him, like a rugby ball, was his head's going towards the floor. I've had to catch him again. It was utter carnage. But that was the first time I've run, because I tried to keep my composure. And obviously, I'm quite a big guy. I didn't screaming, you know, and swearing at the top of my voice. This dog. All these sort of old, well-to-do people around Hampstead were sort of terrified. I managed to keep it together, but you can see me mouthing, when I picked him up, mouthing at the back of his head, all sort of expletives, which we couldn't possibly talk about on the podcast.
I can imagine what they are, though, yeah. Mm. Let's talk about your book, What a Flanker, where you talk about the pain and injuries that come with playing elite-level rugby. James, like, I don't play rugby. I'm a big fan of watching it now, I'm not going to lie. But I grew up playing basketball, which is, you know, by the rules, a non-contact sport.
That well-known Irish sport as well, which is great.
it really isn't, so.
Yes, it's really, yeah.
I don't know about over there. Yeah, we got hurling and Gaelic football. They're the two. So I ended up playing basketball, so you can probably imagine what kind of a teenager I was. So tell us a little bit about, you know, playing rugby and how physical it can really get. And, you know, we obviously know about the ankle injury that caused you to retire that little bit earlier. Like, what other injuries did you go through during your career?
I was relatively lucky till the late stages of it. And I'm very glad that I had my wife with me, you know, in those later stages when things started falling apart, because she was amazing at kind of supporting and helping me. But for most of my career, I was fine. I had, I had to put a screw in my wrist, which was early on in my career. I then had, obviously quite a few neck issues with my neck and my back. I got bulging discs and bits and pieces in that respect. But the first kind of major injury I had was that toe injury. That was 2016. And I started 2004. Okay. So basically I was okay. And then I had an ankle injury I had to rehab. And then obviously that subsequently got worse over time. I had patella tendonitis, but I didn't have anything, you know, terrible. Like, I never had to have my shoulder reconstructed. Never did my knees, which is great. But I now sort of, you know, I struggle now and basically have to keep moving just because of things like the arthritis in my ankle, bad toe, you know, I've got three bulging discs in my back, my neck, you know, things like my fingers. I had to have two fingers reconstructed because I dislocated one of them.
Yeah, these are the things that as fans we don't get to we hear about it, like, but we don't really pay attention to that sort of stuff. You know, say to me, if you were playing now and it's like, oh, you know, James is missing the England game because he's injured, that to me is just like, oh, he's injured, you know, like, yeah. Well, who's replacing him, who's coming in? Whereas we don't really get to hear, you know, the in-depth, you know, like, pain behind it all.
Yeah, well, the finger one's an interesting one, because I basically my wife basically always knew, because what would happen is I'd make a tackle in the game and my middle finger on my right hand would pop out.
And she'd see
it. You'd see me hit someone, get up, put my finger back in and then run off.
No.
And then Chloe was like, what? Chloe's watching. And I basically had it heavily strapped. And if I could keep it strapped, it was fine. But after the Lions tour 2017, it was so bad that if anyone shook my hand too hard, my finger popped out and I basically had to walk around strapping on it all the time. And I'd wake up in the morning and my finger had like popped out the socket. I'd switch the light off at night and it would pop out. And
was that really sore?
No, well, it was initially, I mean, basically it was like, no, when I first did it, it was sore. But then basically what happened is it would pop out. And it just means you couldn't close it, so you just have to wiggle it. But if I strapped it,
that just sounds so rotten. Like,
if I strapped it really hard, and basically I got it strapping on it, so it was fixed. And there's a famous Welsh player, British Lion, Wales legend, a guy called Scott Crennel. And I remember seeing him. And he's got massive, big Welsh mitts, and he shook my hand before a game. I was like, Scott, how are you? And he squeezed my hand and my fingers popped out of his hand. And I was like, well, he didn't notice. But I was like, oh, for God's sake. And probably because I'd strapped it, I had to cut all the strap and get my finger back in. So I spent half this time doing this commentary work with my finger hanging out. So I knew after that tour, it was probably time to get that fixed. So those things, you know, I mean, that's kind of part and parcel, but Chloe will watch me get up and she'll just shout posture and I'll have to stand up straight because I'm just a bit bowed over. My old man's heading that way. And my grandfather was basically folded in half like a question mark. So
you can see yourself in the future through him already.
Oh, I caught myself in the mirror yesterday. And I was like, oh my God, I'm literally turning into my dad. And it's that terrifying moment where you realize you are turning into your parents.
I hope your dad isn't listening here, man.
He doesn't know how to use a podcast, so we should be all right.
James, you've been campaigning around head injuries in rugby. So I'd love to hear more about this because I read an article, an interview you did with Sky Sports, and one of the quotes that really stood out for me, which from a sport point of view, you know, like, I mean, I'd like to be a parent one day and get one of my kids involved in sport. But when you read a quote like this, it kind of makes you consider it because you said that you were always concerned that you were doing things out of fear and never out of science. And obviously, you know, being from Ireland, like rugby is such a massive sport for us over here. More and more kids are starting to do it. So can we talk a bit about that and why you have been campaigning around head injuries in rugby?
Yeah, I mean, look, the comments originally were in relation to doing things out of fear, purely. I'll give you an example. So, you know, we'd start a week. You've got a big game on a Saturday.
Yeah.
Most coaches would go, right, Monday's an easiest day. Tuesday, right, it's our contact day. You know, we need to do some contact. Forwards need to do this, you know. And it's like, why? Well, because we've always done it. Well, that's not a reason for doing it. Well, you know, we need to get the mental mindset right. Okay. I need to fill someone in on a Tuesday to help me fill someone in on a Saturday. This is the massive gap in between. Like, what's the thought process behind it? Well, you know, that team over there are doing it. Okay, well, why are we doing it? And there's, you know, and it's just those kind of thought processes that, you know, rest is a bad thing that I was talking about. Subsequently, the head injury thing is, look, I think we live in a world now where a lot of common sense has sort of gone out of the way and we sort of, you know, people are perpetually offended, perpetually afraid. And you've got to understand, rugby's a contact sport, right? You're not going to make, it's like boxing, you're not going to make boxing safer, you're not going to make MMA safer, and you're not going to make rugby safer. Any contact sport is a contact sport. What you can do is look after the players better, look after the science better, make sure you don't overtrain them. Maybe tinker with some of the rules, but you can't ask the boxer just to gently hit the bloke. You know what I mean? Which is essentially what they're trying to do in rugby.
Yeah.
And I think you've got to understand that if you get into these games, the potential to get injured is there. And we're not going to change that. And we should stop trying to change that. And it's down to parents and you know, kids, if they want to get involved in it, get involved in it. You know, nobody ever got into boxing going, oh God, I can't believe it. I got hit. You're like, yeah, it's boxing. You know, I might have brain damage. Yeah, you're getting repeatedly hit on the head. But what did you think was going to happen? And so what I was thinking about the concussion stuff is that people could probably just, you know, we could do more in terms of understanding it, do more to protect people, take decision-making out of players' hands because, you know, a concussion, for example, I get concussed on a Saturday, come in on Monday and I feel okay. Mm-hmm. You know, you need, and I don't feel okay, but I'm not going to tell the truth. I would go and train because
you want to play at the weekend. Yeah.
Yeah. People think they're invincible. Like, you know, there's that Baz Luhrmann song that Chloe always talks about to me. And it always says, you know, that the race is long. And at the end of it, you always, you know, you only realize you're racing against yourself. And also when your knees are gone, you'll miss them. And the point is that when you're young, you do all these things to yourself and it's like, great. Trust me, you know, getting dementia or, you know, playing through injury going and having no knee joint and having to get it replaced, like these aren't fun things. Like I limp around all the time trying to take the dog for a walk. I caught sight of myself walking past the shop window the other day and I was like, oh my God, like, is that what I walk? I mean, first of all, is that what I look like? But B, is that how I walk? And Chloe was like, yeah, I don't really notice anymore, but you're always limping.
I love how she said that. So she's noticed it ages ago and hasn't.
Oh, yeah, of course she has. Yeah.
Hasn't even told you.
Yeah, she said to me, what did she say to me the other day? I said, I've got a neck like a rodent or something. She calls me, you know, pugs. Pugs have like rolls on the back of their heads.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
She calls me pug neck fat back.
I just love your relationship. Sounds loving. It sounds like complimenting towards each other.
Yeah, she says, "Tell them what I call you." I can't, babe. It's not that. I call her lovely cuddle munchkin, don't I? She's sitting off.
This is where you need two sides to the story for sure.
Yeah, it's fine. But we're not going to get her side on because she's not invited on to Wellfest yet. She was actually going to do. She was supposed to talk at the your event that obviously got cancelled. She's much more qualified to talk to your sort of, you know, listeners and clients and people than I am. She's sort of transforming 800 women's lives online every 8 weeks. And I don't know what I'm doing, but tending to be a DJ, running after my dog.
You're running after your dog being a DJ. Yeah. No, it sounds fun still, man. we were talking earlier on actually about the press, for example, and how, you know, literally something like that we all experience in everyday life, our dog runs away, we run after and we can go get the dog, whereas you go do it and it's plastered everywhere. And then I can only imagine what it's like, you know, playing an elite sport as a professional, that you do anything that can be considered stepped out of line, and it's everywhere. So
yeah, I mean,
so between, you know, that on top of, like you said, you know, going into training with that mentality where, you know, you wanted to play at the weekend, I can only imagine that it would have an effect on your mental health. So can we talk a bit about that? Because I know that you are, you know, a major advocate for, you know, promoting, you know, especially men talking about their mental health.
Yeah, look, I think there's a few things. I think, you know, firstly, I mean, I'm nothing but, well, slightly below a Z-list celebrity. I'm sort of straight into like the commas and asterisks below the numbers, if there is.
So that's what you think. So we know you're humble anyway, James, you know.
Or is that just all the pretense? If I tell people I'm humble enough that I can just do what I like,
I'm not Britney Spears.
People, I'm just really humble, and then you just go off and do something completely unhumble. I had a friend that used to say stay humble. We just changed it to stay crumble. But if you say it quickly enough, people think you stay crumble, bro. You're fine. Do you say humble? You're like, yeah, that's what I said. Look, the media aspect's interesting because I fully understand that it's a business, you know, and things like social media and the media are the media you don't control, but social media is the only PR you can control, and you can shape your own narrative and target yourself. And I truly believe it's a fantastic tool for business and selling stuff. I think other than that, it's awful. It's the worst invention that's ever been created by humans. I think, you know, if we could switch it off, I would go for it. And I think if you don't have a business and you're listening to this podcast, and ask yourself why you're on it, and I don't know why you like people that you wouldn't care about and wouldn't let into your normal life, into your world, and then base everything around that. And I think that is a huge cause of mental health issues. I think mental health, especially for men, you know, we do a lot of talking about it, which makes us think we're doing something about it. But actually, talk on its own is irrelevant. You know, it needs to be matched up with action. And it's still the biggest killer of men under 40, male suicide. The numbers have gone up. The more we seem to talk about it, it's more going up. People still don't understand how to see a way out of it. And I think I post a video on YouTube about men reaching out, just a bit of an SOS. And everyone's like, oh, talking, you know, that does nothing. You know, if you talk to people, open up, you're going to, you know, it doesn't work. And I'm like, no, what you've confused it with is not just about saying, you know, it's about the reason you talk to people is to get the tools to make yourself better, to see there is a way out. You don't just sit around a campfire with a guitar, you know, crying about stuff and think that's it. The first step is to find somebody, a professional, a friend, someone that you can trust, and say, listen, I've got this issue. And what every man says and what every woman says in these situations is, it's different from me. You wouldn't understand.
Yes.
It's different. And everybody says the same. Oh, yeah, but it's a unique situation. You've got a billion people saying that same thing. No, it's not. It's just the optics you're seeing it through make you think that it's different, but it's not. There's a lot of common traits. And what you have to do is get some help. Ideally from a professional, not because psychologists suddenly have a magic wand or a therapist have a magic wand to make you feel better, but you fix yourself. And once you realize that only you can fix you, but sometimes you can't see how to do that and you need to find people to give you the tools to do that, to then take action, that's where it's the perfect combination. So to all the, because people comment and go, our talk means nothing, you know, and it's like, no, you've confused it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what I think people don't understand. And then we've got a whole generation of kind of people expecting others to fix them.
Yes.
Getting that, only you fix you, and you need to find the tools to do that. And I think men just need to understand that they're not dealing with this on their own, that there are ways out. It doesn't matter how difficult the situation is. And most people struggle with paying bills, addiction, and, you know, feeling like they're letting themselves down. But there are ways out of all this stuff. I remember some bloke wrote to me asking me to give him 30 grand. And, and it was a sob story, right, about, you know, he gambled, he's supposed to get married. I said, so why haven't you told your partner? Oh, it's too embarrassing. Oh, so it's not embarrassing enough to ask a rugby player you've never met.
You've never met in your life, yes.
Yeah, and I Chloe was like, why'd you bother applying? I was like, you know, my brand of kind of help is a bit more direct and self-love. And I just said to mate, you know, what are you talking about? Like, you know, you need to speak to your missus. You need to do this. Go and get help. You know, declare yourself bankrupt. Go, you know, we have lots of things in society which can help you, which can set you back. But it's better than killing yourself, and it's better than begging people online to give you money. And I just think the listeners, if men are listening, and women as well, just find somebody that you trust and open up to them, because, you know, it doesn't matter what you think's going on, somebody will feel the same way. And one thing you've got to remember, and this is what I always find amazing about media and social media, is that we make our lives a perfect, but everybody is the same. Even the most famous celebrity you could think of, Tom Cruise, versus someone you've never met. Everybody's got something going on. Everybody has an insecurity. Everybody has a fear. Mm-hmm. Everybody has problems. Everybody has good days. Everyone has bad days. Nobody doesn't care what people think. Everyone goes, I don't care what people think. Yes, you can get better at hiding it. And if you're in a massive mansion with piles of cash, you can pretty much blank some of that stuff out. Mm-hmm. But when you're alone at night and you switch the lights off and you're in your own head, then you're back to reality. And I just think it's important to remember that. Because Chloe and I did a podcast called Couples Quarantine. And I got these people writing in, and we got amazing questions all the time. And they people going, well, when are you going to get some real life people on? Like, what do you mean?
Oh, wow. Oh, so just because you guys are well known, they were assuming that you were real. And I was like,
So what my problems are different from you? Well, you don't have the financial. Yes, I do. You don't know what's going on.
You have no
just
idea.
Just because I don't walk around going, I'm in this situation, I'm in that situation. And that's what media does. It separates us and makes us think. And then that's why we're so shocked when you see, like, you know, a celebrity break up, or a celebrity have a meltdown, or a celebrity do something else. They're like, oh, maybe they do share the same things we have. Yeah. I'm not talking about me. I'm talking about proper celebrities, you know?
Yeah. And when was the first time that you then can say that you went and you got help? And was that hard? Like, was that decision to go do that? Was that hard?
I was 17.
That's a great.
I basically had really bad self-confidence issues, and I still have them now in terms of backing myself, which doesn't necessarily sit very well because I'm such a show-off and I'm always like chatting and obviously have confidence to do certain things, but a lot of self-doubt, you know, around anything I do. So, you know, I've branched into lots of different careers now, but all of them, you know, even my DJing stuff, you know, am I any good? Will I make it? What can I do? How can I get better? Oh, I didn't enjoy that. I'm worried about my mistakes. You know, you get 1,000 positive comments, one negative one. Oh, I'm fixated on that. Maybe they're true.
Yeah.
And at 17, I my godfather's wife is a psychologist, a lady called Dr. Jill Owen, and she was amazing. And basically he said, listen, I think you should speak to Jill. Can really help you. And I was like, well, I haven't got your problems. I don't have any of these things. I assumed that you have to get on the old therapist chaise long couch and sort of start crying. And obviously she went to me, no, we can help with performance. We can help with you preparing for games. We can help with you dealing with disappointment. We can, you know, strengthen your mind to execute skills better. And I was like, really? Can you do all this stuff? And I started at 17 and I'm 36 and I still speak to her, still speak to other therapists. I'm the biggest advocate of it ever. I think that, you know, all the listeners in here, if I told them, right, listen, mix these ketones in this drink, you're gonna lose weight, you do it. If I said you buy these trainers and you run fast, you do it. Mm-hmm. If I said, right, listen, try this new supplement, it's gonna fix everything, you'd all do it. If I said to you, you know what, you could speak to a psychologist and change your entire life, every aspect, relationship, your mentality, your performance, your success, how you deal with things, stress levels, by speaking to a psychologist or a therapist or whatever in the brackets that would help you, you wouldn't do it. People just don't do it because they're not prepared to do it. And mm-hmm. I am the biggest advocate of doing that. I've tried hypnotherapy. I've tried everything. All of them have their place. Mm-hmm. And it's about finding the right person to click. And it's like buying shoes. You know, not every shoe fits. And you've got to make sure that you find the right ones that suit you. But once you do, it can transform your life. And I could not believe it. And if it wasn't for her, I would never have had the success I've had. I would never have achieved what I've achieved. I've never dealt with the stresses. I would never have had the mentality I've got now. I would never have achieved anything, all because of those early, sort of 10, you know, 10, 15, 20 years of working with her to make me a better person and deal with all the stresses. Because, you know, I came from quite an old school mentality. You know, my dad was very critical. the coaches at WASP very critical. Mm-hmm. There wasn't sort of an arm around you culture, which is what I needed. I was a confidence player.
Yeah.
And telling me that I was rubbish and going to just go and get better. I would go and do it, but I needed the direction. I needed the tools. I needed to know how to, you know, to deal with disappointment. And she taught me all of that.
Yeah. And how do you think, like, say, family and loved ones can, you know, or even strangers impact positively a man's mental health? Because the reason why we'll stick with males for this one, because there is a bit of a stigma around it, because, you know, James, like you're a big guy. And like you said, you've had a successful career. And even talking about that couples podcast you did, people coming at you, suggesting that you guys weren't normal just because they thought they knew you. You know, I find that bonkers. I still do. And you've gone into the DJ career and stuff. We'll talk about that in a couple of moments. But, you know, how do you think that family and friends can really help with a male's mental health? Do you think it's different to helping with a female's mental health?
No, I think women are better at helping each other because they're open. You know, if you ever go into what women's WhatsApp group, it's like, oh, I've had a breakup. Right, we're gonna get the rosé taxi around your house.
Yeah, let's get the hair done. Yeah.
Yeah, let's have a chat. Oh my god, poor you. Oh, you must feel terrible. Lads, WhatsApp group. It's just, you know, naked pictures, dodgy things, and stupid memes, and just abusing each other. Especially in a sportsman's group. You know, Chloe. Obviously, she's got to know the rugby kind of environment for a while. And she was like, you guys are awful to each other. No wonder you've all got confidence issues or you know, all got sort of problems just because we're so cutthroat. But there is a huge, huge importance in a relationship capital, I called it, surrounding yourself by good people. And how many people in your life do you know that are always miserable, always negative? Life's always dealing them a blow. It's always somebody else's fault. It's always their partner's fault. It's the government's fault. It's, you know, everyone else, it's always down to somebody else's reason for their failure, their unhappiness. And to be honest with you, it sounds brutal, but some people are just like that and they're never going to see a way out of it. They can't see. It's much easier to blame everybody else than to take acceptance that it could be them. And that's why, when, you know, when you were younger, your mum always told you, go, listen, don't hang around with so-and-so. You know, they're bad influence. And I was probably that bad influence that most people got told to stay away from. But your mum's right, because those people, if you surround yourself with good people, it can make a massive difference. And in my, you know, it doesn't matter how mentally tough you are. No man is an island. No woman is an island. And if you are struggling, you know, you sort of have a certain, I put them in different buckets, buckets of willpower, buckets of determination, buckets of mental strength. And at some point they can run out. And, you know, it's hard to, you know, unless you're super mentally tough, to pick yourself back up and go again. And you learn and you do that through practice and resilience and challenging yourself other things. So if you run out of willpower, you know, it might be then you then turn to a competition with a friend and going, right, well, that's why I'm doing what I'm doing. Or it might be competition with somebody else that they don't even know you're in competition with. Mm-hmm. But you need good people around you for when those things are low, and you need people who can help make you a better person. And that is so important. And I lucked out with Chloe, genuinely lucked out. And the reason why I married her was because my life is better with her than without her, and that she made me a better person. And when the chips were down and I was, you know, thinking about giving up, she comes in and helps me. Even like last night. So I put my radio show together and I was DJing and I was like, she came in, I thought I was with my head in my hands, I think, listening back to what I was doing. And she's like, what's wrong? I was like, oh, I've made a couple of mistakes. And just the fact she spends sort of 10, 15 minutes just talking about, you know, making mistakes, why we do it, this is what we do, you know, meant to enjoying it. Just that ability to give you, to help you see the wood for the trees and to put your arm around you, to take the time to do that.
Yeah.
That's a good person. That's a good soul. And, you know, we need people around us like that who are going to help us. And we need to be surrounding ourselves with like-minded people to help us be successful.
Let's talk about the fitness world and what your approach is to it now versus what it was as an elite athlete. Has it changed much? Am I wrong in assuming that it has?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, the beauty of the fitness industry and most things in science is constantly evolving and constantly moving on. And my approach now is very different to what I was doing as a player. You know, I sort of had on and off is the only modes. Now I train differently. I train very much goal orientated. My knowledge of nutrition has gone up and you know, I understand how to change my body, how to, you know, I mean, at the moment I'm 113 kgs. You know, 8 weeks ago, I was 122. Before that, I went up to 130.
Oh, wow.
All that kind of knowledge base is completely changed. And it kind of makes a big difference. You've got to keep up with, you know, with the evolutions of going on. And I also think it's an important lesson to reach out to people that are doing what you want to do and better, and get advice, and mm-hmm. be always keen to improve and have self-development. And that's the truth. And I think fitness and health is the one thing you can really control. You've only got one body. So how you develop it, how you look after it is important. It's a definite, you know, when all else around you is failing, how you eat, how you treat people, how hard you work, how you develop your mind, and how you look after the body are the only guarantees in life. The rest is out of your control.
Yeah. Oh, I really like that. I like that a lot, actually. And when you put your fitness into, say, everything well, that you've done with rugby, which you're not doing at the moment, but I mean, you are a DJ, you're an artist now as well. You've released a brand new single. Like, when do you sleep? Like, how do you live a balanced lifestyle? Because I presume to live a balanced lifestyle, you need your 7 or 8 hours a night. So how do you do it all?
Well, I actually always sleep 8 hours, and ideally slightly longer, because I love The Rock, for example, Dwayne Johnson. What a man. The guy, everything he touches turns to gold. What an incredible bloke. But this whole thing, you know, like only sleeping 4 or 5 hours a night, like, it's not clever. It's not great. You know, even like someone I follow, Jocko Willink, the ex-Navy SEAL, and he's up at 4:30 every morning, you know, talks about go getting it. Like, science shows you need your sleep.
Yeah.
Like, you desperately need your sleep. Your brain cleans itself while you're asleep. It removes all the plaque, all the stuff to help you recover and perform all the functions. And people who sleep and don't sleep properly, the statistic of getting dementia and those kind of neurological diseases goes through the roof. So, you know, I think the foundation is recovery and sleep to everything you do. But I basically just try to split my day up into different sections. I'm very goal orientated, and I think it's really important to feel like you're chipping things away and chalking things off. And you know, everything I do is what I love. So you find time to do what you love. A lot of men in particular, they go, oh, I want to make money. So they go off and do all the stuff they don't care about, aren't passionate about. And lo and behold, it fails. Most people you find who are super successful really love what they're doing. And it's the kind of the perfect storm. And all the stuff I do, A, involves sort of performing. As I said, I'm sort of an intolerable show off. And everything else is kind of, I do what I love. And that means that it doesn't feel like work to me. And yes, you know, you don't want to be a jack of all trades and a master of none. Uh-huh. And I think for me, I'm trying to streamline down what I do. But it all involves storytelling with music, storytelling with words, storytelling with books, storytelling with after dinner speaking and you know, in podcasting. And it's all performance. And that's what I love to do. And I've learned through, you know, failures in business and trying to do too much that this is probably the best way of doing things.
Yeah, because I can just take away from what you said right there. Obviously, it's easy to balance your life when you're doing everything that you love. I mean, when you're essentially not squeezing stuff in, you're looking forward to doing it, you know, which is great to hear. It's great to hear somebody, you know, who is so passionate about one thing, who isn't doing it anymore. And you can find new passions that you love so much and still live that balanced lifestyle. And also listen to somebody promote sleep. I'm like, I'm the same as you when it comes to that. I'm just like, you need to sleep. If you don't, like, that's the first thing you need to get sorted in a healthy lifestyle is getting your 8 hours sleep a night, 100%. James, I can honestly say it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. It really, really has. You've been probably one of the easiest people to interview because I haven't had to do any talking at all. And I'm sure I'm not the first person to say that to you as well. So before we let you go, you know, regarding the likes of the mental health and, you know, achieving your goals, whether it's in sport or music or even becoming an author, is there any advice you can give to our listeners before we let you go?
Yeah, look, I think people always talk about how to get better. And just saying to someone, you know, be more successful, be a better you, you know, be healthier. What do these things mean? And the best piece of advice I can give you is it's never about getting to the end goal. It's all about the journey, which sounds cliche, but let me explain what I mean. Is that you can split. So, for example, if you look at your trying to be healthier, I want a healthier body. COVID has taught us that health is wealth. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't just go out and exercise, eat right, do everything else. You've got to split your life up into different sections and understand that it's like about incrementally getting better. So when I said I want to be healthier, you look firstly, look at your sleep. That's a separate section. Look at, you know, and then you think, well, how do you improve your sleep? Well, then you break that down to what's your room setup like? What's your lighting setup like? What's your routine before bed like? What's your hydration before bed like? What's your nutrition like? That's 10 things I've given you to improve sleep, which mm-hmm. is a subsection of getting healthier. I then say to you, right, let me see if I can improve your diet. Okay, well, how do you do that? Well, first of all, what is your goal? And by improving your diet, you know, You know, what is your time constraints like? You know, what kind of food do you like? You know, how do you want to get better? You want to lose weight, you need to start tracking calories. And then that's another subsection. And then you sort about going, your training. Well, what's your goal? Well, you know, do I get enough steps by walking every day? Do I sit at a desk every day? Do I, you know, what kind of training do I want to do? What are my limitations? And suddenly I've got, and I could go on. You suddenly split all these things down to it. If you're getting 2% better in each one of those areas, by the end of the week, you'll be 10% better than you were on your path to being healthier. And you didn't, and it's not so intimidating. And you suddenly are focusing on the process. And that's the most important thing. So if anyone always says, I can't change this, I can't do that, I haven't got time, I don't know how to do it, you're talking rubbish and you're lying to yourself, and you'll always be a failure unless you understand that you can change it. And it's about finding a plan, finding a goal, breaking your life down into manageable sections, even things like relationships with people or even your work life. How can I be better at my work? How can I get more money for my job? Well, are you personally developing yourself at a skill for your job? So are you reading around the subject of your job? Are you putting extra hours in? What's your relationship like with your staff? People, you know, what's your timekeeping like? What's your performance like? What, you know, all these kind of things you can split up, and suddenly you're putting yourself in a better position to be more successful at work. And it's become easier, and it's not such a scary bigger picture. And I think if you can break your life down into these manageable chunks, make a plan and execute it like that, you will be more successful.
Yeah, no, I love that. I love the bit where you said, you know, for anyone listening right now who feels like they can't do it, to have someone like you on the podcast say, you can do it. I think that's going to mean the world to our listeners for sure. James, it's been great chatting to you. It really, really has. You know, hopefully we'll get to see you at Wellfest when it's back, and hopefully we'll get you on the podcast again. So, you know, for anyone who has never heard of you before the podcast, where can they find you?
Yeah, so I'm all over social media, as you imagine. I'm on Instagram at James Haskell. I've got a Facebook page under James Haskell Health and Fitness. I've got a couple of podcasts myself. I've got my series called What a Flanker, based on my autobiography, but it's me interviewing Carl Cox, Jack Whitehall, Jimmy Carr, Warren Gatland, to name a few sort of, you know, and different people I'm really fascinated with. I've got my podcast, The Good, The Bad, and The Rugby, which is all about kind of, it's nothing to do with rugby, but it's all about kind of the personalities and fun. And so you don't need to be a rugby fan to enjoy it. And then I've got my house music podcast called Back Row Radio, which goes out once a month. And that's kind of tunes for you to train to, the latest house music, and just a rave up if you're at home or in the car.
Yeah. And of course, that brand new single. I hope it's going good, James. I really do. And thank you so much again for speaking to us on the Wellfest podcast in association with KBC.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Wellfest podcast with me, Marty Guilfoyle, brought to you by KBC. Remember to check out wellfest.ie for more free health and wellness resources. See you next time.